Hi folks, I am Alan Watt and this is Cutting Through the Matrix.
And that's how the world really works, because it's not Disneyland, it's not a happy little place with nice clean little middle class streets and everybody on bicycles and everybody knows everybody else and so on. It's really pretty nasty at times. And the characters that run the world tend to be of much the same ilk. And if they have the right qualities of psychopathy, it doesn't matter if they're right wing, left wing, or what they happen to be, they're recruited by organisations. Because if they're psychopathic and they've got a bit of brains in them, they can be useful, awfully useful to those that run the world. That's how they recruit them. It's like the civil service. Most of the civil service, you know, in most countries that I know of, the people don't even go through into universities. They're often recruited right from high school. And that is their apprenticeship, is once they get in at the bottom level. And they're there for life, you know. That's their job, their life. They know what they have to do, and they're well rewarded for doing it, well rewarded. And they're often intergenerational. They marry each other, a lot of them. And that's because they don't have to have resumes put in. Their parents are their resume, and their grandparents. They're like lineage. They're generations of bureaucrats and civil. That's what George Orwell or Blair, and his real name was Blair. That's where he came from. So the real world is really it's the machinations of real deceit and conning. And pretense, and we who are being fooled have to participate in our own deception by deciding to ignore it, you see, and pretending that, well, you know, it's not that bad, is it? Or really, see, George Orwell knew this, and he was a darling of the world socialists at the time, when he came back from Spain, until he started talking out. He connected the dots between the communist system, the socialist system, and the German socialist system. They're both totalitarian movements. And systems which are totalitarian always, remember, this is awfully interesting and awfully necessary to remember, they always say that you, the people, are, and they give you the label, you see, the country, etc., the system. You are all. You're the Soviet system, or you are the Nazi, etc., etc. But the fact is, this is an old technique that's always been used. It's much more sophisticated in the techniques to put it over today, of course. They always do this. They did the same thing in communist China when they took over there to starve the people, kill the farmers, yada, yada, yada. That's what they do, folks, when they come in. And believe me, hunger is a great, great persuader to accept anything, including your little crust of bread. You'll be made to feel grateful for it. It almost makes me think to the other movie, awfully well done, by the way, Land of the Blind, it was called. Donald Sutherland was in it. And it's about a younger guy who was initially working for the military, who helps to overthrow the government, the tyrannical dictatorship or king or monarchy or whatever it was, and install Donald Sutherland, who'd been in prison for years as a revolutionary. And then it turns out that once Sutherland's in, he becomes a tyrant himself. With delusions of grandeur and wants instant obedience and so on. And the guy who had helped him to get in eventually turns out he speaks out against him and was put in terrible prison conditions and solitary confinement and all different kinds of punishments and torture. And part of the thing you're taught to say is when you're asked about what you like to eat, and you have to repeat, or what's better than a nice juicy steak? You say, it's a nice mouldy crust of bread. That's what you have to reply, or you're beaten, almost senseless. And I keep thinking of that when I see these ridiculous things put out there by Bill Gates and others about eating different kind of substitutes for meat and so on. It's just too close. So much of this is too close to what's happening today. I really see it happening. And how you're supposed to be content with it, like George Orwell said, his job during World War II was propaganda. He ran the Foreign Affairs Department for India, as a broadcast to India that was fighting the Japanese on his borders and outside his borders. And but he also did the cooking hour, where he had to convince people, he said, that they had to eat stuff that was really undigestible and not fit for human consumption because of the war. And he had to try to convince them it was actually better for them and healthier. And they put out these articles. Oh, the people had never been so healthy in their lives. It's just astonishing. It's astonishing, you know, how nothing changes, the lies and deceit towards the general public for manipulation. And it's disgusting. It really is. Anyway, I'll get on with this here. But I'm trying to say that basically things are vastly different, vastly, vastly different than you'd imagine. I read some articles this week about some people in Britain who like to have debates, who get, you know, in public and universities and so on, who've been banned from universities because of their previous views and their present views on certain topics. And he was banned, and I think his talk was going to be freedom of speech and censorship. And so the student unions and so on banned him from giving his talk at a particular university. And universities are supposed to, were at one time the pinnacle, supposedly, I don't think they ever really were, but they're the pinnacle, supposedly, of free speech. If you lose free speech, you're under tyranny, if you don't understand that. And if you lose one area of free speech, then there's always one to follow it and get added to it and added to it until literally you're in a corner somewhere, like George Orwell's 1984 and Winston had to write in his diary, trying to be out of sight of the camera in his room. That's where we are right now, actually. But this particular guy, it was Peter Hitchens, he said that you have to remember that these students, it's easy to forgive them, oh, you're students and you're young and all. But these students, he said, will become the civil servants, the CEOs, and the teachers and professors they'll teach the next generation. And if they're so intolerant now, what are they going to be like when they're in charge of everything? Really, what you're seeing is the implementation of the worst tyranny this planet's ever seen. And I really mean that. Because as bad as 1984, George Orwell's book was, in its portrayal of a future, at least there were some places, perhaps outside of a camera, you get away. And our total surveillance society, hell is staring us in the face. And you better become a good PC robot if you want to survive. That's where it's going to be. When you will eventually be picked out because you had wrong think, you thought something and it was a wrong thought, like Winston's neighbour in 1984, where when Winston is in the jail, you know, in the Ministry of Love or what it was called, where they tortured you, naturally, then he met his neighbour there, and his neighbour said, oh, he says, my daughter, his young daughter, who's about 10 or something, wearing their little outfit of socialism. Because all socialism has outfits, uniforms, for those who don't quite get it. There's also uniformity of behaviour. There's uniformity of speech. There's uniformity of topics which you'll talk about and push and opinions you're going to have. It's like a cloning effect they all have with each other. But he meets his neighbour in there and says, it's my daughter that found out. I was saying something in my sleep, but I didn't know it. But she found, thank goodness, she did the right thing and turned me in. And that's how you're all going to be. You'll feel guilty for thinking something. You already do, Pavlovian style, because indoctrination is so scientifically, incredibly, amazingly accurate with today's technologies and methods, methodology. So yeah, he tells you what they would do. He's not fantasizing here. He's saying his version of it, and many of his compatriots were giving the same versions of it and the same big think tanks, etc., of the day, belonged to the same organizations. Don't forget that Russell himself belonged to MI5 during World War II, and he and George Orwell, in fact, Blair, worked together sometimes, even at the BBC and outside the BBC, in different think tanks as well. And they also worked with Kessler that came out with Darkness at Noon, and Far Left, almost communistic, I suppose, and a few other books as well, well known for it. So they all worked together, and they used a lot of communists, by the way, for MI5 during the war for propaganda purposes. And they threw drugs out there like you wouldn't believe. Drugs are awfully important by those who rule the world. Don't forget that Britain and America flooded, absolutely flooded, the coast of China with bales of opium until China capitulated and let them in. And they started to divide up certain parts of the coastline there for British sectors, French sectors, American sectors, and so on. People forget that. Initially, the Chinese didn't want anything to do with the nasty folk from the West, you see. But that's how they did it. And there's well-known names today, I won't go through them, old families who were made a fortune off the opium industry. And don't forget, too, that George Orwell's family were a traditional intergenerational family of bureaucrats who served the British Empire. The royalty. And his father, at one time, was a governor general of I think, of Burma. And he was in charge of Her Majesty's Opium Company. Not George himself, but his father was at one point. And I think it was a politician called Thompson in the 1930s, brought it up in Parliament. Everybody thought that opium organisations were done for because of the terrible publicity when folks actually found out what had been happening. Never mind the fact that even Britain itself had been flooded with opium in the 1800s by some well-known characters who were awfully good at using it and pushing it under the term for medicinal purposes. Is that familiar to you? Medicinal purposes. Medical purposes, eh? And they put the stuff in everything from cough mixture to whatever, to everything, absolutely. And laudanum and so on, or different derivatives, etc. They were hooking people, but it was lucky, it's actually lucky for the working classes of Britain especially, who couldn't afford the darn stuff. But the thing is too, it's lucky they preferred beer. Isn't that amazing? That saved them, a lot of them. And so they shifted their attention to promoting it across the other parts of the world. But yeah, they used it definitely against the Chinese. That's a reason too that Britain used to be into pushing up the Khyber Pass, as they call it, and into Afghanistan, was for the drugs, for the opium. And even today we have got lots of footage of Allied troops, as they call it, guarding the poppy fields, because the first thing we did when they took over Afghanistan was to start it growing again. The Taliban that ran it before that had banned it. And once it happened again, then you have the different heroin derivatives from it, and it gets flooded across the world. It's for an expertly run society. It's the same thing that Orwell hints at too. Because he was so fanatical about it, he did go over and fight with the left-wingers against the government of Spain, for instance. He definitely was on board with much of their ideologies, but he turned against them supposedly when the communist faction were using the socialists from all the countries like Britain and so on. Then they were killing them, because communism really did believe there could be no other gods before them, and no rivals for sure. But they would use them and then dispose of them, and he thought it might be targeted too. But you got to understand, this guy was trained at the top university, just like Lawrence of Arabia was taught the same thing, to go over in the Middle East and subvert that country with incredible propaganda techniques and so on, before he went into actual warfare. They were trained by the British establishment, this strange entity that most folk don't understand at all, especially folk who live in Britain. They really don't. They really, really don't. They think it's just the vestiges of a system that's antiquated and just developed by itself from the days of imperialism. Partially true, of course, but it didn't develop by itself. And the city of London never had any preference for the British peasant over other peasantry in the planet. So you have to understand, what on earth did Orwell envisage for himself and others who were fighting in the Spanish War? And what did he hope to gain from World War II, for instance? in World War II, he helped actually work out the propaganda, and he worked for the Department of Information. And actually, that's all these terms went into his book, Ministry of Love and all this kind of stuff, and the Department of Information. But he worked for it in the BBC, and he was responsible for making up the propaganda that was mainly broadcast initially to, well, his main job initially to India and that the areas over there, for listeners there. But it was propaganda nonetheless, and other forms of propaganda, which he admitted, such as having a daily show to do with cooking and telling the people how to eat stuff that was much more nutritious for them. Listen to this. So nutritious, that was a propaganda. But it was stuff that would normally get thrown away and had very little nourishment value at all. The people in Britain were being starved, really, with rationing. George Orwell talks about it. Now, George Orwell is a mysterious man because he belonged to the upper middle class in an intergenerational family of workers for the what they called the imperial system at that time, the British imperial system. And he also was trained in this strange progressive, they call it progressiveness, for instance, for those who don't quite understand it. Most folk can say it all the time, but don't really understand what they mean. To be progressive, you must be progressing towards something that's already drafted out to be coherent and meaningful. But it's never told to the public what they mean by that. When the upper middle class are for it, you have to stop and think a minute here.
I know that when you enter the main ones for dictionaries and so on, it's just like George Orwell said, every year they're getting thinner and thinner as they create linguistic minimalism. That's the fact that if you can eliminate descriptive language from the language itself and reduce the vocabulary, you cannot convey full ideas to anyone. George Orwell had it in his book 1984, A Department of the Dictionary. And when they reduce it to a state where it's very difficult to get an idea across, there'll be no more terror. You can't be a thought criminal if you can't convey your message to someone else. Quite simple. And they call it linguistic minimalism at the top. That's been done. Look at the dictionaries from 100 years ago. Look at the ones today.
George Orwell mentioned it in Animal Farm, where the pigs, of course, who were in charge, they were the bureaucratic class for the animals after the rebellion. And the pigs had written their constitution down, you see, in their Bill of Rights and on the wall. And then, of course, some of the animals noticed in the middle of the night there, if they weren't quite sleeping, the pigs would sneak in there and put a ladder up on the wall and go up there with paint. They didn't just score things out. What they did is add little amendments to the ends of sentences. And again, I keep jumping back to some of the excellent seers of their time who were quite dead on about the future. And that was Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, and George Orwell with 1984. And really, 1980, and Animal Farm too, where he predicted a world in Animal Farm. So much of it's coming to true right now, by the way. Read the actual book. Don't just look at the cartoons and stuff. Read the book, and you'll find all the things he said would happen. And here they are today, yeah. If you understand it all, analogies, etc. It's Orwell talking about the press. Most folk don't know that he did a preface to his first book in 1984 that was taken off from subsequent books because it might offend folk, and he didn't want it removed, but he was talking about the press themselves and how the press go along with totalitarian regimes, including Britain. He said you didn't have to tell them what not to print. They would go along with it voluntarily. The so-called free press, right? But he also talked about censorship of speech and so on. And he says these people don't see that if you encourage totalitarian methods, he's talking about the left, far left and so on, which is no different than the fascist systems that they had. They're really one and the same thing. I don't care what you want to call them. It's the same thing. Run by the same people, actually, who own the whole system. To get change in the system, you need two sides. You create them. And you plan the conflict and you plan the outcome. It says these people don't see that if you encourage totalitarian methods, the time may come when they were used against you instead of for you. Make a habit of imprisoning fascists without trial, and perhaps the process won't stop at fascists soon after the suppressed daily worker, this is what we had in Britain at the time during World War II, had been reinstated. He says, I was lecturing at a working men's college in South London. The audience were working class and lower middle class intellectuals. The same sort of audience that one used to meet at the left book club branches. The lecture had touched on the freedom of the press, and at the end, to my astonishment, several questioners stood up and asked me, did I not think that the lifting of the ban on the daily worker was a great mistake? When I asked why, they said it was a paper of doubtful loyalty and ought not to be tolerated in time of war. So anyway, he ended up defending the daily worker, which even had libeled him at times. He knew to stand up for other people's points of view. Or you're in a totalitarian system completely. The very thing you're supposedly standing up to fight against, you have become. You always become your enemy, unless you're conscious of what you're working through. People in a mob are never conscious, because they've lost their individual ability to think for themselves.
You know, Alan, when I was sitting in that arena, the XL Energy Center in St. Paul, and all those 15 or 20,000 people were screaming for McCain or screaming for Pollan, you know what I mean?
Yep.
What? How? That is powerful news in mainline press, is it not? How does that reach those people? At what level?
It's, I think George Orwell probably explained it better in his book 1984 than anyone else. And he talked about, and Animal Farm too. Animal Farm, he talks about the fact you always got to get a bulk of the cheerers, he called them the sheep. Two legs good, four legs bad. And then they reverse the saying halfway through and the sheep don't even notice. But you've always got this fanatical group who truly think they're part of a system, and they think they're the winners within that system. They have no idea outside of it what's really going on themselves, but they are the fanatics who live in a very narrow-viewed world, and they're technically ignorant of the bigger picture. But it's necessary to have these people, big organizations and followers, to deceive the bulk of the population. That's the key to it. They're just, to me, they're just another form of non-governmental organization. The key, as Marx said, is you must create mass movements. And mass movements is very, very important. And once, in fact, they encourage that, the creation of mass movements. Once you do that, you simply put your own man at the top, and now you control the minds of millions and the direction of millions. So the creation of NGOs and mass movements is very, very important to deception and to lead the world along the path it's been destined to follow. Planned that way by the big boys.
You know, at one time I started looking at all organizations as cults, because if you look at the characteristics of a cult, you'll find that most organizations have some characteristics in common with those main characteristics. Have you ever thought of anything sort of like that? Looked at it like that?
Yes. What it is a form of tribalism. I read about this years ago. The whole view of politics, mass movements, etc., and how the elite were already using this in their own strategies to gain power and to use the willing fools, as they call them, to work their projects into reality for them. They use tribal terminology. You'll notice, for instance, every nation has its creation myth. They give you a creation myth to make you very proud. Then they give you the tribal leaders. Now you have dynasties of them, family dynasties, so they're familiar to you. So it's the chief's son idea, and it strengthens this tribal nature. And they use tribal symbols. You have a flag as opposed to a skull on a pole or whatever, but it's the same idea. They use all of this, and they use music that you're familiar with that brings tears to the eyes. High emotion is very important, emotive qualities in the speeches. And they use these certain terminology, which are catchwords, which stimulate the emotive responses that you've already been conditioned with from school onwards. So this is a form of mass mind control, and it's based on tribalism. So therefore, a survival mechanism, which is tribal nature, is now understood and scientifically used against you.
but that's what Orwell was really about too. And when he found out what real communism was, he says it's nothing like what he thought, his idea of what socialism would be. And so he became its enemy very quickly. Anyway, he says freedom of the press, and this was a foreword in his book Animal Farm. If you think, you see, it's not new. It's oppression and censorship is not new. It says the book was first thought of so far, this the actual book, Animal Farm, as a central idea, it goes in 1937, but it's not written down until about the end of 1943. By the time when it came to be written, it was obvious that there would be great difficulty in getting it published, in spite of the present book shortage, which ensures that anything describable as a book will sell, and in the event it was refused by four publishers, only one of these had any ideological motive. Two had been publishing anti-Russian books for years, and the other had no noticeable political colour. One publisher actually started by accepting the book, but after making the preliminary arrangement, he decided to consult the Ministry of Information. The Ministry of Information is real. We all have departments of information, especially today, because we're under this strange terrorist thing. Terrorists just spontaneously come out of nowhere. And so we all are under your corporate-type management, you see. Anyway, get back to the article. It says, so the Minister of Information appears to have warned him, or anyway, strong advised him against publishing it, his book. And he gives an extract from his letter and so on. It says here, this is what the publisher got, I guess. I mentioned the reaction I had from an important official in the Ministry of Information with regards to Animal Farm. I must confess that this expression of opinion has given me seriously to think. I can now see that it might be regarded as something which it was highly ill-advised to publish at the present time. If the fable were addressed generally to dictators and dictatorships at large, then publication would be all right. But the fable does follow, as I see it now, so completely the progress of the Russian Soviets and their two dictators that can apply only to Russia. So that was why they didn't want to publish it. The same thing happened, of course, with 1984, which was published, I think, in 1947-48. But this one here, Animal Farm, he wanted to get published during World War II when, of course, they were in bed with the Soviet system. Don't think the Soviet system can't... Forget the fact it was Russia. That system can be put anywhere. In fact, I think there's more communists who are actually living in the US right through that entire period right up to the present time. And because you don't use the word communism anymore, doesn't mean that's not what they are. Often, it's so tragic that folk have to be given an actual name to identify something. If you don't get the name, you see, they don't think about it. And that's why those who control you use names awfully frequently. They label you, you see, and they can get you to write hate somebody or whatever it happens to be, or a group, or you name it. That's what your governments do. Anyway, it says here that... this is from from his own publisher. I think the choice of pigs as a ruling caste will no doubt give offence to many people, and particularly to anyone who's a bit touchy, as undoubtedly the Russians are. This kind of thing is not a good symptom. This is Orwell again. Obviously, it's not desirable that a government department should have any power of censorship, except this is awfully important for folk who are, unfortunately, we get overdosed with data every day, and most folk don't remember it. And that's why you have to be selective in your thoughts and selective in what you're thinking and selective in the topics. Everything else is just bubblegum. But back to his article, and he says, this is obviously it's not desirable that a government department, this is Orwell, should have any power of censorship. It's not desirable that a government department should have any power of censorship. And he says, except security censorship, which no one objects to in wartime. See, this is what I said before. Well, now it's terrorism. You can't say that. See how we work as a you suddenly become like a super tribe, basically. It doesn't matter how many cultures are involved. You become a super tribe when you think you're under threat. Yeah, sure. You can ration me, you can do this, you can do that. Okay, yeah. It says, over books which are not officially sponsored. But the chief danger to freedom of thought and speech at this moment is not the direct interference of the Ministry of Information or any official body. If publishers and editors exert themselves to keep certain topics out of print, it is not because they are frightened of prosecution, but because they are frightened of public opinion. In this country, intellectual cowardice is the worst enemy a writer or journalist has to face. And that fact does not seem to me to have had the discussion it deserves. Any fair-minded person with journalistic experience will admit that during this war, official censorship has not been particularly irksome. We have not been subject to the kind of totalitarian coordination that might have been reasonable to expect. The press has some justified grievance, but on the whole, the government has behaved well, has been surprisingly tolerant of minority opinions. Except for the folk who didn't want the war, they locked them up, eh? The sinister fact about literacy censorship in England is that it is largely voluntarily. So this is so important. Government likes you to go along voluntarily, but you know there'll be consequences if you don't. You see, that's what law is, actually. It's always coercion. It's always sitting about, you're kind of coerced along, you know. But if you say no, that's when you get force applied, you see. That's how it all works. You get punished or your license gets withdrawn for whatever it happens to be, you name it. Unpopular ideas can be silenced and inconvenient facts kept dark without the need for any official ban. Anyone who has lived long in a foreign country will know of instances of sensational items of news, things which on their own merits would get the big headlines being kept right out of the British press, not because the government intervened, but because of a general tacit agreement that it wouldn't do, as you say, it wouldn't do to dimension that particular fact. So far as the daily newspapers go, this is easy to understand, but British press is extremely centralized, and most of it is owned by wealthy men who have every motive to be dishonest on certain important topics. But the same kind of veiled censorship also operates in books and periodicals, as well as in plays, films and radio. Understand what I'm saying before? It isn't just me saying that. Your propaganda is embedded as well, not just things kept out, but propaganda they want you to believe is put through children's books and movies and everything that you read. You don't realise how brainwashed you are, as you think you'll enjoy yourself. At any given moment, there is an orthodoxy, a body of ideas, which is assumed that all right-thinking people will accept without question. See? It's not exactly forbidden to say this, that, or the other, but it is simply not done to say it, just as in mid-Victorian times it was not done to mention trousers in the presence of a lady. You couldn't even say lady anymore. Anyone who challenges the prevailing orthodoxy finds himself silenced with surprising effectiveness. See, peer groups can be trained very quickly to turn against someone who is thinking outside the box. And they really do. People like to huddle together like penguins in their little groups and sects and whatever it happens to be. Remember the studies I read from, again, university studies on peer groups and propaganda and indoctrination. And they found the different groups from working classes and different men, women, and so on. And they found that the ones who were middle class, basically middle class, who socialized, they adapted to all new policies very quickly, very quickly. And they'd talk about it with their drinky poos as they stood there and chatted to each other. And they'd all have the same books, the recent ones that were suggested. And suggestion, see, is like an order. Yeah, well, yes, I've got so-and-so's book, isn't it? Yeah. And you see, they've got all the right things and et cetera. And they'll wear the right things and they'll drive the same things and yada, yada, yada. They're very conformist. So it's easy to manage them. Very easy. And when it's anything said from professional bodies, they immediately parrot it without thinking. They'll never question it. The folk who had less education question things far, far more. So education domesticates you more and more and more until you can't retain any natural survival instincts. This is not my word. This is the studies that they've done, you see. But anyway, I'll get back to Orwell's little article here. He goes through different parts of how different countries kept down free speech, etc., etc., etc. Well, look what's happening in all our countries today, where you've been told what to believe about everything that you turned everything upside down, and even they can put you in jail for not going along with what you're told to say, what you're told to say, or what you're told to call somebody. You're in trouble, folks. We're all in trouble here. This is a scientifically controlled society, if you haven't figured it out. From myself, Alan Ward, it's good night to me, your God or your gods go with you.